This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.
Hello and welcome to our latest podcast episode. My name is Chris Brown and I'm a partner at Hall & Wilcox. Today we are discussing impact investment. How and why do investors invest with purpose and what should they look for? I'm delighted to be joined by Scott Fletcher, the Chief Investment Officer at Woodbury Private. Welcome, Scott. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and Woodbury Private?
Hello, Chris. Great to be with you. Woodbury Private is a multi-family office advisory firm based in Sydney, and we have a focus on high net worth and ultra high net worth families and individuals. I'm responsible for leading the firm's investment activities, most notably private asset consulting and virtual family office services we provide. And that includes, which links into the topic at hand, working with clients to align their investments to their purpose, their values, preferences, or as one client recently described it to me, helping me put my money where my mouth is. So things like impact investing play a really important role in turning, I guess, what we call good intentions into investable actions.
Good stuff. So, Scott, I've got here a copy of the Responsible Investment Association's 2022 benchmark report on responsible investing in Australia. They're saying that of approximately $3.6 trillion of externally managed funds in Australia in 2021, about $1.5 trillion were responsibly invested, or at least that's according to the definitions that they use in their research. But only about $30 billion of that was, quote, impact investment. What in your world is impact investment and how does it differ from ESG?
Yeah, there's lots of terms and phrases used in this space, as you'd expect, and the Responsible Investment Association survey is part of that. So if you look at different surveys, you will often find in the impact investing world different categorizations. When I talk with clients, I found it helpful to think of responsible investing as an umbrella term, under which you can have four categories that fit on a spectrum. Now, that's not an absolute global definition of anything, but it's trying to bring together a whole lot of different lexicons, if I can put it that way, of impact investing. So if we think of responsible investing over the top as an umbrella term, the four that I would generally fit underneath there, starting on the left, for example, if you think of the spectrum, I would start with values-based investing. Then we'd move to the right one box through to ESG tilted, and ESG being environmental and social governance investing. Then if we move one box further to the right, we're into the world of responsible thematics, which are things like sustainable investing funds, climate change funds, those sort of things. And then finally, we'll end up at the other end on the right-hand side with impact investing. And the values-based investing is just to clarify or define a couple of those phrases. Values-based investing, I'd suggest, is the oldest form of responsible investing. So we're going back a couple of centuries, not probably going back as far as big hooded monks and 1,000 years ago or anything like that, but it very much aligns with religious and philanthropic groups. So if you think of anti-slavery, morals-based type of themes or involvements of those religious and philanthropic groups. The second one is ESG tilted. And this is a more recent phenomenon and it's really evolved as the investment tech, I guess, has evolved with it in terms of our ability to identify different factors, different type of characteristics mathematically. ESG tilted is really based on screening analytics and procedures to generate a set of securities. It could be stocks, it could be bonds, with a required ESG profile. For example, exclusions from a market portfolio. You might start with an ASX 200 or in Australia or an S&P 500 in the States. And if you wanted to exclude things like tobacco, alcohol, fossil fuels, those type of screening criteria, you can do that with an ESG screening approach. That's what we call a negative screen. If they use a positive screen, it's really building a portfolio from scratch. And that's where we move into that third box, responsible thematics. So if we have a portfolio that intends to be a climate change thematic, a sustainable thematic like that, you can actually use an ESG tilting approach or a screening approach to positively identify the stocks that you want in there and only have those stocks in that portfolio. Then we move finally to the impact investing space. And as we go from left, values-based, through to right, it becomes far more private market because you can imagine the larger amount of money you have or the bigger the scale and the more direct involvement you have, even hands-on in some of these investments in the impact space, in the private market impact space, the more impact you're going to have. It's just makes sense. So impact investing is really, to me, is about investing in typically underserved areas to develop solutions that generate a positive social and environmental, typically, impact alongside a financial return. So the two go together. If I think about the term in terms of the difference between ESG and impact investing, and at the risk of oversimplification, you can almost think of ESG as a framework scanning for good corporate citizens or a scorecard from a scorecard of past activity, whereas impact investing, you can almost think of as more of a strategy. So you're actually actively looking for opportunities that lie ahead and align to your investor preferences and values. So ESG, in that sense, is based on backward-looking analysis to derive characteristics. Impact investing is more of a forward-looking from the outset type of activity. ESG has really gone mainstream these days. So if you look at all the funds that are around, mainstream funds, it could be multi-asset funds across different asset classes. It could be shares, it could be bonds. And they don't even call themselves ESG or sustainable. There is a strong element these days of ESG that go into those funds and those portfolios, because as a fund manager these days, if you want to get ratings and approvals from research houses, one of the key criteria they will have is, what do you do on environmental and social governance in this area, this area, and this area? So regardless of the terminology used, at the end of the day, it's about aligning your investments and your wealth with your purpose.
That's great, Scott. That's very, very comprehensive. Thank you. So you mentioned impact thematics. Can you give some examples of these thematics? What types of project, venture, or business are you seeing impact investors going into?
Well, they're really as varied as the people investing in them. So if you think of projects and early stage startups across areas like renewable energy is one that comes to mind. And this can include even crossovers to other thematics like Indigenous support, development of Indigenous communities, for example. I think of solar array projects in remote areas, which fit that bill. Another one is social disability housing, future of food, agriculture and farming tech, medical research. A recent interesting one that I've come across is nanotech applications for cancer treatments, which is a really leading edge developing area. And then there's other ones like disruptive digital technologies impacting supply chain. So that whole technology thematic may just be seen as a bit of a return grab or a return driver for people, but technology is at the heart of a lot of the impact type of space as well. So the areas of focus typically have a lot to do with a person's skill set and experience. So leveraging their raft of knowledge for the greater good, if I can put it that way. In some cases, investors will take board seats and take a very hands-on role. For others, it's more arm's length.
Okay, understood. Look, mindful of the data from RIAA, where they suggested that it's actually still quite a sizable chunk of funds under management, but only $30 billion of FUM out of a universe of $1.5 trillion, which they say is responsibly invested in Australia. Mindful of those data, has impact investment taken off in Australia in the same way as it may have done overseas? What are you seeing and what can we expect?
Well, the starting point is really that it's the governments that have been the key drivers of ESG adoption and innovation and impact investing, therefore, and it's the pension funds, endowments, and more recently private investors that have just added to the momentum. Europe definitely leads the way. Australia has been slower to adopt, but impact investing is definitely gathering pace. And that's thanks primarily to large superannuation funds, as you would expect, and changing attitude sentiment toward addressing environmental and social issues. US is a relative laggard, apologies to our American friends, when it comes to the regions, but appetites for impact investing are certainly increasing there as well.
So what do you think explains the regional differences in impact investment track record? You mentioned that the Nordics were strong, or Northern Europe, but the US not so. Is this based on attitudes or is there some other reason? For instance, tax breaks or other financial incentives to make impact investments?
Well, apologies for giving you an economist answer, but I would say it's a combination of different things. There's a few things I'd just call out. One is who's in power. So political ideology has a lot to do with the take-up in particular regions. And that, if you're in power, of course, leads to how much government fiscal policy support is there in terms of project funding, subsidies, incentives, and the like. The size and the structure of an economy is a key determinant as well. For example, if a country's a resource producer or is resource scarce and needs to import it all, and also if the country's involved in mass industrialization, thinking the US, United States of America. Geographic location is also very important. So, for example, in Europe, the closer you are to the Arctic Circle, or if you're a Dutch farmer, there's nothing like, looking across the field at the dike and you're below sea level to sort of sharpen the focus on the need for environmental type concerns. And community attitudes and culture more broadly are key. So Europe really has been more open to those environmental and social impact considerations over recent decades compared to the US. If I looked at those different criteria I just called out, Europe is a more centrist or centre-left politically, and therefore they get that greater funding and financial incentives. They have a smaller resources base. So calling for cuts to mining, coal, oil, drilling, et cetera, has less impact on unemployment and therefore your electoral prospects than it does in the United States, for example. And the communities in Europe are generally more socially and economically liberal than the US. Mm. And Europe, of course, has countries closer to affected regions like the Arctic Circle and whatnot. So it's a mix of those, but who's in power, government fiscal support, and the size and structure of an economy would be key.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Scott, when we started planning this podcast, you mentioned the American Century Impact Investment Survey, and RIAA has recently released its From Values to Riches report on consumer demand for responsible investing. So it's clear that attitudes are changing towards responsible investing, so therefore impact investment. What kind of investors does impact investment appeal to?
When it comes to private investors, Chris, I'd say it's all kinds, really. Moving beyond stereotypes, which if you go back about 5 to 10 years, they were very much impact investing is predominantly for females, to use the misplaced phrase, tree-hugging activists, eco-warriors, that was the demand, that was the domain of...
Steady.
Exactly. The reality today is more of a balance, thankfully, between the males and females and across economic and political lines as well. Generational differences are more obvious now than ever. So we see Gen Z, millennials are really the key agitators for change, like never before. And even those who previously haven't expressed a strong preference toward impact investing, and this is a really interesting piece that you see across different private wealth investors or high net worth individuals, even they would be more inclined to lean toward responsible investing type of approach now because they're following the tailwinds of return driven by those factors that I mentioned in the previous question about government policy support, incentives, subsidies. Mm. They're following the tailwinds to make a return. So the simple truth, of course, is that the larger and more direct your investment, the more impact you can have on the outcome, and therefore it's the high net worth and ultra high net worth in particular investors that have access to private investment opportunities that are leading the charge. I'd also add that impact investing involves accessing big mega themes, big global thematics, and these can take decades to come to fruition. So one of the really important things for investors to note is that they have to tie their investments to a genuine passional purpose. Otherwise, it's really hard to stay the course as returns change through market cycles. You've got to have a long-term view and investment horizon in mind.
Okay. So you mentioned returns. I think there's a perception, maybe a misconception, rightly or wrongly, that if your investments are driven by your values or your passion, then you'll forsake returns because that's not your primary motivation. But again, you speak about returns. So are you seeing investors having the best of both worlds? Forgive me for saying this, saving the world and getting access to the type of return that only high net worth investors are typically able to access through private opportunities.
Yes, it's important, I think, to distinguish between impact philanthropy and impact investing. So the former is about the social return, obviously, with investment return is either being not important at all or of far secondary importance. The latter, of course, the impact investing, as its name suggests, is about the best of both worlds, as you mentioned. It's about deploying capital to a purpose aligned with a person's passion or values and purpose for a social or environmental payoff and generating that acceptable return, of course. The investors I work with do both of these things, really. But for impact investing, the investment return is still important, even if that return threshold is sometimes lower than they generally accept on other parts of their portfolio.
Sure. Okay. So, look, I understand that your business in relation to impact investments is one of the areas where you've evolved and you're continuing to grow your practice. How would you go about building purpose-driven investment into a client's portfolio?
Investing with purpose is really about building an investment portfolio that reflects more of who you are and what you're about while still achieving those objectives. If you want to build a portfolio like this, you have to first go deeper and move beyond those pretty conventional questions around return, risk, time horizon, what's your starting capital pool, and so forth, and move into the realm of values, beliefs, passions, concerns.
Right.
What matters most to me, those really hard personal questions, which often lead to a very interesting discussion at times within families or between couples, because they're covering aspects of their reason for investing that they haven't really thought about before. And don't forget that in any type of responsible investment, it is still an investment portfolio that's comprised of risks and exposures that must be adequately managed. So you can still lose money. So the long-held principles of sound investing still apply, obviously.
Yeah, sure.
Once we discuss and identify goals, objectives, risk tolerances, the more conventional things, it's then that the more interesting purpose and preference discussions take place. And this is where impact investing really kicks in. So I had to summarize the steps for building a purpose-driven portfolio. You can think of it as identifying a unique set of goals. Everyone's unique, everyone's different. But you have to identify those unique goals about yourself, your family. And that's important because it tells you where you're going to invest. It gives you a set of objectives, of measurable investment objectives, and sets up an asset allocation, if you want to put it that way. That's the first step. You add to your unique goals, unique preferences. And this is really, as I mentioned before, where impact investing really comes to the fore about how you want to invest that. So the first area identifies the where to invest. Unique preferences are all about how do I invest. And then the investment toolkit is the what and the who. So the investment toolkit, what I mean by that is the menu, like going to a restaurant, creme brulee, like I do, unfortunately, and it's not available at that restaurant, I can't have it. Very similarly, if you've got a certain preference in an impact area, but there's no way to translate that to an investable solution, well, then the answer is obvious. You're going to have to make some trade-offs along the way. And all of that together equals what we call my way of investing, or the investor's or the client's way of investing. It reflects who they are and what they're about.
Okay. So can you give us a couple of examples of where clients have made impact investments? And just to sort of put a bit of color on that, were these investments where the client said, Scott, I've been thinking about investing in a particular purpose-driven investment opportunity. Help me find something. Or do they find an opportunity themselves, which would clearly be, the ultimate personalization? And do they say, Scott, what do you think about this? How does it work in practice?
Sure. Well, renewable energy, energy transition, social disability housing, as I referred to this before, they're the more recent examples that come to mind. As part of our investment discovery process, we really first try and identify the need for responsible investment solutions to start with. Not all clients have a specific need or have communicated a specific need for responsible investing. So it's a broad church, being across an entire client base or an entire market segment. We then take clients through an extensive menu of themes and causes grouped by environment, social, and the like. And that leads to a discussion about their top preferences, for example. This is somewhat oversimplified, but I think it makes the point. That list that we use and discuss with the client isn't meant to be exhaustive and isn't exhaustive, but it's really a catalyst for discussion. Often you'll find that clients will start talking about preferences, thematics in the impact space or responsible investing space that we haven't even thought about. So it's quite interesting in that regard. Once we've worked with the client to identify their top preference areas to focus on, We then conduct a search through various private market and research doorways, for example, that we have in our network. Then you move to a short list, discuss and iterate with the client. So it's a two-way discussion at all times. And then we run those preferred opportunities through due diligence and internal approvals, and then move to recommend and implement if and as required.
Okay. So, I mean, what I'm hearing is it's sort of fairly high touch private investment opportunity, very much in the private market, and you know, dare I say it, beyond the reach of investors such as myself, who, you know, typically invest in managed funds. You know, putting that to one side, do you envisage a time where true impact investment, you know, getting close to what you described in your last answer, true impact investment will be available more widely within funds rather than on an individual private investment basis? And just, again, to sort of seed this discussion a little bit, I suppose that cost is an important factor, given that these opportunities, the best of these opportunities, are typically found in the private market. And there's a hell of a lot of due diligence and monitoring and stewardship and involvement by the investor in these opportunities. Can that be translated into, I guess, broader appeal for Australian investors?
Yeah, certainly, Chris. And we're actually seeing that already in recent years, I would suggest. So we're already seeing an increasing number of private market impact funds available to Australian investors. And that's not just the ultra high net worth. It's not even just the high net worth. It sort of comes down. And that's because when you think about it, anyone that's invested in a large superannuation fund, an industry fund, for example, will have elements of exposure to impact. The real issue is, what is true impact? It's more about how can you specifically align your specific preferences and values and passions to that investment. Harder to do when you don't have as much scale as, say, an ultra high net worth investor has, for example. But we are seeing more of those private market impact funds becoming available, both domestic type of funds where there's a far more limited spread of themes, and global ones as well. So they're obviously more diversified in terms of their themes, impact themes and regions. Though the costs are, of course, as you mentioned, generally significantly higher than what direct equities or public market fund investors would be used to, of course. That said, there's also a more recent evolution of direct crowdfunding type of approaches to direct impact investment opportunities. And that can be a much lower cost experience for the impact investor and far lower investment minimums for private investors. So it's not just the cost, it's also the thresholds you have to pass in investment amount to access some of these traditionally and realistically more institutional type of approaches. So the product or opportunity sets are evolving quickly. Direct investments versus funds, all trying to make it easier for private investors to avoid those large institutional minimums I just mentioned, while keeping the costs within reach. That's certainly happening now. This is where your point about doing thorough due diligence comes in, though. There are such a large amount of competing causes, themes, investment opportunities, yeah, sure, in the impact space today. And you mentioned the RIAA. There's also a number of impact conferences around and seminars, all different groups. All with some fantastic sounding ideas. But just because something might align to your purpose and sounds really good, it doesn't mean that it will be a good investment. And so due diligence is critically important when assessing impact investment opportunities, as it is for other types of investments, of course. So on that note, I'd just like to repeat again, because there's so much different terminology, there's so many different ideas about this cause or that idea or that impact area. Just because an investment opportunity aligns with your purpose, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good investment. Do your homework first.
That's great, Scott. Look, thanks a lot for joining us today. There's plenty of food for thought there. I've certainly learned a lot more about impact investment as a result of our discussion, and hopefully our listeners will too. So thanks, everyone, for listening today. Thanks, Scott, for joining me in this discussion. Please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website or connect via LinkedIn. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much.